Welcome to The Slow Melt. I'm Simran Sethi. This is the moment where I usually highlight our sponsor. But these are the last shows of the season, and I want to get real with you. Those sign-on deals you hear about from our sponsors, they're not covering our costs. Not by a long shot. The Slow Melt is a labor of love made by people who aren't getting paid enough or getting paid at all. So if you want a second season of the show, please consider a donation via our website. We don't have a Kickstarter or Indiegogo or Patreon because, frankly, all the time we have is dedicated to making something great for you to listen to and then finding ways to do paid work to cover costs. So I hope you'll consider sending us what you'd pay for a chocolate bar. That might be a buck, it might be 20, every bit helps. If you'd like our chocolate-loving listeners to know about your business, contact us for a media kit about sponsorship. And please make a commitment to subscribe and encourage your friends to do the same. I said this last episode, and I'm gonna say it again. When I say Choco love for tuning in, I mean it. So thanks, and Choco love.
About 70% of the world's cocoa production comes out of West Africa, mainly two countries, Ghana and Côte d'Ivoire. The other 30% comes from a variety of countries in Latin America and Southeast Asia. And Brazil and Ecuador are particularly important sources of small production of fine flavored cocoa. What's particularly unusual about cocoa compared to other global commodities is that it's a crop that's grown almost entirely by small farmers. Almost 90% of the world's production comes from these kinds of small estates. For a commodity which is so essential for global consumption, and particularly luxury food, it's quite striking that most of the farmers who produce cocoa live below the national poverty line. Typically, that means making less than about $1.90 a day.
That's Rick Scobie, the president of the World Cocoa Foundation, explaining why Africa is central to chocolate and highlighting one of the region's greatest challenges. There is no chocolate industry without Africa. We'll hear from Rick about payment and other issues later in the podcast. But remember, it's one of many stories about the continent. If you've been listening to this podcast, you know I love saying that. It's not just one thing. African cocoa is bountiful and painful, cyclical and dynamic. Today, we're going to get two snapshots of the region told through the eyes of an industry advocate, Rick, and a journalist who you'll hear from shortly. It's impossible to cover the totality of a continent in 23 minutes, so we split this show into two parts. In the second part, we'll speak with a cocoa broker based in Tanzania on cocoa beyond West Africa, which is the dominant region where it grows. And as with our last show on Latin America, I want to remind you that these stories are parts of a much bigger whole. They're a sampler. You can find leads to bigger stories on our website, on the episode page, and under resources, what we like to call inclusions. We're going to start our exploration with Orla Ryan, a journalist now based in London who spent 5 years in Africa reporting for the news agency Reuters, and just over two of those years in Ghana, where she wrote about cocoa and the commodities market. She spent most of those years traveling between Ivory Coast, in French Côte d'Ivoire, and Ghana, the two biggest producers of cocoa in the world. And she wrote an indispensable book about what she learned called Cocoa Nations, Living and Dying for Cocoa in West Africa, that was published in early 2011. If it's not already in your library, add it. It's the most comprehensive overview of cocoa in West Africa that I have ever read.
Most reporting on commodities that is done in sort of capitals such as London or New York, they involve looking at a screen and seeing prices moving up and down. And but you get to Ghana, and honestly, you know, this is sweat, blood and tears. This is, you know, every single bag of beans counts for something.
These bags feed into the commodity supply of cocoa that's traded on global markets and purchased by companies involved in cocoa processing and trading, and by big chocolate manufacturers like Mars, Nestle, and Hershey's.
Reuters makes a lot of its money by selling specialist news to traders. So anything that happens in Ghana or Cote d'Ivoire, whether that's a bad storm that affects the crop, whether that's a strike at the port, which affects shipments, whether that's an election, whether it's riots, this can affect the price of cocoa. In commodities markets, this was an incredibly important position because the news that even though a lot of the time I felt that I was asking quite innocuous questions, sort of about the weather, for example, I was like quite shocked by sort of the intensity of the response. I remember once when I went to Kumasi, which is sort of in the Ashanti heartlands, a lot of cocoa was grown there. And I think I was wanting to speak to a local, not particularly senior official about the cocoa crop. And the response of his receptionist was, well, how is it in the interest of Mother Ghana for him to speak to you? And that's how serious, that is how seriously they took cocoa. And that was sort of how much of a threat that somebody like me coming in to ask questions about the crop was perceived as being. I think in Ghana, there's 800,000 cocoa farmers. In Cote d'Ivoire, there's about 1 million. And for both of these countries, so this is changing slightly as they both discovered oil, but it's one of the big foreign exchange earners. And even if it's no longer the biggest foreign exchange earner, for an awful lot of people in both countries, it's how they make their living. So if in Ghana there's 800,000 cocoa farmers, add on 4 or 5 people who depend on that income. And in a country of 20 million people, you're talking about a hugely important crop. A report from Reuters that said, you know, the crop this year is going to be a bumper one. So, you know, supply is going to be really good. And then the price dropped. Then the government or the cocoa marketing board would essentially be selling its cocoa for a cheaper price. And this would have a direct impact on people in Ghana and on the money that the government would make. So somebody in my position, and now I think Bloomberg, Dow Jones, as well as Reuters, they all have people working in Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire doing the same kind of thing that I do. They often met with a lot of resistance because this was seen as incredibly sensitive information.
This is the backstory to what economist Laurent Pepitone talked about in episode 4. The information shared by traders and journalists transforms what's grown and can upend the livelihoods and lives of farmers.
You know, there's a saying, cocoa is Ghana, Ghana is cocoa. And it wasn't, you know, because people loved chocolate. It was just because the crop really took to the soil there. And, you know, this industry grew up organically, I guess, in the late 19th, early 20th century. It grew up organically, largely by smallholders. Nobody at that time, not Cadbury's, nobody had any idea of how big chocolate was going to become. So I think sort of in 1895, the biggest export in the world was at Sao Tome. By 1925, Ghana was exporting like 500,000 tons. And this grew up, you know, it's one of the biggest misconceptions, I think, that Mars or Cadbury or the British government or something came in and sort of organized this. Whereas it was much more organic, in a way, much more ramshackle and certainly much more entrepreneurial than that. The market grew faster than people expected. The farmers took to it, you know, with greater enthusiasm than people expected.
The crop was grown by small farmers then and is mostly grown by small farmers today.
And therein lies a lot of the problems, one could argue.
Countries in sub-Saharan Africa grow about 3/4 of the world's cocoa. But the farmers behind the crop earn about 6 to 7% of the value of a chocolate bar. So if you spend $1, the farmer earns about 6 or 7 cents. Edward George, part of the Pan-African commercial bank Ecobank, says farmers used to earn much more, up to 50% of the value of a chocolate bar back in the 1970s and 16% in the 1980s. Now, most of the money is made in processing cocoa beans, turning them into chocolate, and selling them. A new report from the credit ratings company Moody's says Ivory Coast, Ghana, and other producing countries in Africa are more vulnerable to shifts in cocoa prices because so much of the population works in agriculture. And because manufacturers and traders are concentrated in a smaller number of companies and tend to have greater bargaining power. But that doesn't mean farmers don't have agency, which Orla explains is rooted in history.
There's this famous farmer called Tete Kwashi who, in theory, brought the first cocoa pad from Equatorial Guinea to Ghana and planted it, and it just took off. I think Tete Kwashi existed, but certainly when you go back through, there's the Basel missionaries, there was a colonial farm at Akwapam, there was a few sort of tentative efforts to try cocoa, but there was nothing big, there was nothing organized. They were trying other crops as well. Nobody knew that cocoa was going to take off. And then at the same time, the sort of technology to develop chocolate was getting better. So as the market took off, farmers just responded to it. And, you know, Cadbury's and those other buyers were there. But there's certainly no sense that there was big organized plantations. They started in the east of the country and then they kept chopping down forest trees and planting cocoa pods and they moved west. And obviously, when you get to the west, we then push up against the border in Cote d'Ivoire. When Cote d'Ivoire got its independence in 1960, the president, Houphouet Boigny, essentially said, you know, whoever can dig up the land owns it. And this was a statement, or whoever can work the land can have it. And this was a statement that has huge historical import for Cote d'Ivoire, because lots of people from Burkina Faso and Mali, all these Francophone, incredibly poor countries to the north, came and, as immigrants are everywhere, worked incredibly hard to develop this land. And then as Cote d'Ivoire sort of fell on harder times, the people whose land, and I use quotation marks here, whose land it was, because obviously it was very disputed, or who said that they'd never received enough money for the land in the first place, you know, sort of said, these immigrants have done so well from the land, they're not really Ivorian, we want that land back. I wouldn't say that was the reason for the Ivorian Civil War, because it's sort of very complex, but that issue of identity and that sort of issue of ownership of land was certainly one very fraught aspect of the sort of Ivorian sort of civil war. In Cote d'Ivoire, it was immigrants. In Ghana, it was sort of Ghanaians predominantly, but it was the same thing of sort of people coming in, entrepreneurial, recognized there was a market and working damn hard to satisfy that market and to make money from it. So those were the similarities, but they ran the market in very, very different ways.
This is the part of the story that rarely gets told. How the organization of the cocoa industry within the countries where it's grown has a huge impact on how farmers are treated and what they actually earn for what they grow.
When I first got to Ghana, one of the things that actually took me a while to fully understand was that the Ghanaian cocoa market is controlled by the Cocoa Marketing Board, known as CocoaBod. And they set a price, they buy the cocoa from the farmers at that price, and they export it. And they are the only exporters. So Mars and Cadbury are not going up country and buying the cocoa beans from the farmer. Essentially, the Ghana Cocoa Marketing Board, CocoaBod, a government body, sets the price and sells the cocoa. And throughout Ghana's history, because it was a fixed price, it was the easiest way for the Ghanaian government to make cash. But certainly there's anecdotal evidence, and you certainly see a news report from the 1780s talks that farmers were getting between 10 and 20% of the world market price. They don't get that now.
Meaning the split with CocoaBod is more equitable.
One of the most interesting things is that Ghanaian cocoa is essentially controlled by the Cocoa Marketing Board. In some ways, it's very good because it gives farmers a voice. I mean, the guy from Cadbury or Mars might be tempted to mess with an individual farmer who has 5 acres. They're not going to mess with the Ghanaian Cocoa Marketing Board, which essentially controls, you know, the world's second biggest supply of cocoa. So it gives the farmers a voice. But it is very, very political. And in poorer times, it's the one, you know, the government can really control that cash, and farmers can be hugely, hugely, hugely overtaxed, and they get very little support.
But it can also work in farmers' favor.
Ghana essentially has two main parties. There have been several peaceful changeovers of power, and you have a country where democracy, actually, it works. People leave power and new governments get power. And so in that sense, it works quite well. So that essentially politicians do have to pay attention to farmers, because they are voters, and there's a lot of them.
This may be why, during recent emergency meetings about the price of cocoa dropping to its lowest price in a decade, the Ghana Cocoa Board said they wouldn't lower the prices paid to farmers for their upcoming harvest. Now, contrast this with Cote d'Ivoire. Back in March, the country confirmed it would cut the minimum price guaranteed to farmers by almost 40%. But what we have to keep in mind is that cocoa exports account for about 43% of all exports from Cote d'Ivoire, compared to 24% in Ghana. Cote d'Ivoire's challenges are more intense. But, of course, governments aren't the only ones affected by these changes. So I asked Orla if chocolate manufacturers should also be responsible for the welfare of their suppliers, the cocoa farmers.
It's a very good question. On a purely sort of practical sense, if they are thinking about their future of their businesses, then they bear responsibility in that sense, because there will be no future unless farmers make an income from it and unless this becomes sustainable.
And that brings us back to Rick Scobie, whom you met at the top of the show. Rick is the president of the World Cocoa Foundation, a Washington, D.C.-based organization funded by members of the cocoa supply chain, with the express goal of promoting sustainability in the cocoa sector.
The big cocoa processing and chocolate manufacturing companies, for several years, have tried to address the problems of the poverty situation of the farmers, the low productivity yield of the existing farms, and the very poor technology and farming knowledge that the current cocoa farmers have. But what the cocoa processing and chocolate industry realized several years ago is that they were basically competing with each other on long-term sustainability. A company like Mars would have its own program called Vision for Change. Another company like Mondelez, which owns Cadbury and Toblerone, has its own competing program called Cocoa Life. So about nine of the leading companies that account for almost 80% of cocoa usage several years ago agreed to collaborate on a new sustainable investment program in Ghana and Côte d'Ivoire to help the cocoa farmers.
It's called Cocoa Action and has two primary goals. The first is to increase the productivity of the land where cocoa is grown and, in turn, increase yields. The second is to support broader communities of cocoa growers.
We're finding that the younger generation is not interested in staying in farming generally and cocoa production in particular. They're going to the cities, they're going to farm more high-value crops that will give them a higher and faster return.
Sam Maruta spoke about this same problem with Vietnamese cocoa farmers in episode 6.
This is a real problem for the cocoa companies and the consumers, and also the governments in the countries where cocoa is produced, because they want to make sure that there is a diversified economy which provides jobs and income to rural communities, particularly in the agriculture sector. So the fact that we're going to have dwindling number of farmers with dwindling production because the actual efficiency and productivity of the existing cocoa farms is very low, particularly in Africa. This means there's going to be a global deficit in the future.
I know a global shortage of cocoa might be hard to envision during a time when we have such a glut, but Rick's right. If farmers leave cocoa and grow other crops, or leave agriculture altogether, then the supply will suffer. No cocoa farmers, no chocolate.
So under Cocoa Action, the cocoa companies are investing in education, making sure that the primary school systems are functioning and well-staffed. In addition to investing in the education system in these cocoa-growing communities, the companies have also been very focused on providing capacity building and business skills training to women farmers. Women have been a very important source of the production, harvesting, and fermenting of cocoa, but in the traditional African societies, they often haven't been given access to the credit and training that they need to become strong farmers. So Cocoa Action is trying to improve the livelihoods of the communities and the productivity of the farmers.
What do you say to those who, you know, say that the initiative is great, but there's challenge with implementation?
The downside is that we're only reaching 300,000 farmers out of a total global community of about 6 million farmers. So that really is only about 5% of the global farming community for cocoa.
The chocolate industry earns about $100 billion a year. So shouldn't Cocoa Action also focus on increasing the share paid to farmers?
The World Cocoa Foundation and our 105 member companies, and particularly the nine big cocoa processing and manufacturing companies, all have a commitment to ensure increased income and livelihoods for these cocoa farmers, most of whom live below the poverty level in really dire situation. That's why the World Cocoa Foundation decided to recruit someone like me from the World Bank, who's worked for 35 years on rural development and poverty reduction, because the industry realizes the issue is not just about improving the productivity of farmers' yields with cocoa. It's also about reforming policies in country and globally that rob the value of some of the cocoa production from the farmers. So, for example, in country, we have the governments taking a large share of the profits of the cocoa production from the farmers for their own taxes and their own investment needs. I think it's important that the governments should be transparent on how they use that money. In other industries, like extractive industries like oil, mining, minerals, there's been a global movement to have the governments disclose how much revenue they take from the producers and how they spend it. I would love to see a similar initiative with the cocoa boards in West Africa. There's also money lost from the farmers' pockets by dreadful marketing and transport infrastructure. A lot of the product is lost or delayed going from the farm to the storage to the processor. And if we can improve the efficiency and investments in logistics and trading, there'll be more value retained in the country for the farmers. There's also no question that at the global level, the price of cocoa needs to incorporate the real social, environment, and economic costs of producing cocoa. For example, right now, some of the cocoa production has taken place in protected national forests, where farmers looking desperately for more income have cut down valuable trees and damaged the ecosystem in order to scratch out better living. We need to work with the farmers to reduce the pressure on deforestation and make sure that the price of cocoa in the world market actually incorporates these real production costs. So I think the end result of the World Cocoa Foundation and the chocolate and cocoa processing companies and the governments themselves, who really are the most important partners in this collaboration on cocoa sustainability, we all share the same goal of improving the income and livelihoods of the farmers. And if we don't see an increased livelihoods and incomes in farmers in another 4 or 5 years, we're going to see continued exodus of cocoa farmers, continued decline in global production, and that's in no one's interest.
So as consumers, what can we do to help support these efforts?
It's important that consumers be educated about the real sustainability challenges of cocoa and begin to look when they go into the supermarkets and the stores to make sure that the chocolate that they purchase has been produced under sustainable conditions.
How are you defining sustainability?
To the World Cocoa Foundation, sustainability has three different dimensions. First and foremost, it's about profits to the global supply chain. You want to make sure that all of the actors who are involved in cocoa production, the farmer, the trader, the processor, the chocolate manufacturer, are all making a fair return, a fair profit on their labor and their investment. The second dimension is related to people, making sure that the social and community dimensions in cocoa production are equitable and fair. And in our case, we have particular concerns about the continuing incidence of child labor on farms.
Child labor is a complex and frustrating issue. We'll do a deeper dive on it next season.
The third and final dimension is the planet. The cocoa and chocolate companies, the governments, and the farmers have a shared responsibility to make sure that cocoa, which should be a positive crop for the environment because it's a tree crop that can provide many environmental benefits, we need to make sure that cocoa production is environmentally sustainable and does not contribute to deforestation. We also need to be ahead of the curve on climate change impact. One of the most worrisome scientific developments in the past few years has been to show climate change is going to radically alter the growing area for cocoa. By 2050, so some 35 years from now, huge parts of Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire are no longer going to be viable for cocoa production.
If you're interested in learning more about chocolate or Africa, check out the wealth of audiobooks on audible.com. Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to listeners of The Slow Melt. There are over 180,000 titles to choose from for your digital devices. Just go to audibletrial.com/chocolate. That's audibletrial.com/chocolate. The stories of cocoa we've heard so far are about commodity cocoa. But as I said at the start, the truths of African cocoa are multiple. In part two of this episode, our final episode of the season, we'll head east to Tanzania and meet Simran Bindra, one of the co-founders of Cocoa Kamili. And after that, our Makers series, highlighting 9 chocolate makers from 4 continents and tasting their chocolate along with them. We'll hear the stories behind the bars and details on their flavor directly from the people who made them. And you'll also be able to buy the bars they'll be discussing with a Slow Melt promo code, so you can participate in the tastings right along with us. Look for details on the website just before the series launch. As for season 2 of The Slow Melt, we hope to secure funding because we've got ideas for multiple seasons. But we're also always open to hearing more. So drop us a line and let us know what you want to hear more about, and also what you thought of this first season. And if you like what you hear and you really do want more, please subscribe, share this podcast, and consider sponsoring a show or donating. Today's episode was mixed and produced by Sean Corey Campbell, edited by Sasha Woodruff, written by me, and coordinated by Katie Ranke. Choco love and thanks for tuning in.